it as a on the merits, and two-thirds as a tactic to gain extra land. I'm not sure I'd say it exactly that way. I recall that it was being that it may well have been a trade-off to some extent, and in that sense it was subject to the same discussion I mentioned yesterday, that village interests, my view was, that village interests as a whole tended in the final negotiations to be somewhat submerged, maybe not even consciously. And my sense was, in the final going, that there was a kind of a trickle-down of knowledge to the villages, and I recall seeing increasingly more village representatives in our office who were concerned about things like subsistence and the trust land concept and so on, right at the end when the bill was essentially being put to bed, you know, completed and put to bed. As to why it was taken out, I think that Dave's recollection is essentially mine, and that is that as the matter was negotiated out in the final going, the concept of fee ownership and the sacrifice of a greater number of subsistence acres for a lesser number of fee acres became the dominant way of dealing with the bill. I'm not as expert as Doug is certainly on the Senate debate, but they simply decided for a variety of reasons that the mix of those two kinds of ownership was a more creative way to approach a settlement. But as it wound down, the trade-off of those two things was made. Now, one issue again, and I only put this in because I think it's always important to have before us the actions of Mr. Aspinall, and I cannot overstate the effect that I think he had on the bill. He was a person who came to this with very fixed views on how things should be resolved, and he had a staff that had very similar feelings that I had to contend with on a daily basis. And I do know that both Mr. Aspinall and his principal staff, a fellow named Lou Ziegler, is a familiar name to all those who worked on the bill, both sought absolute certainty of all terms, and they were always uneasy with the notion of this trust land concept. They were always uneasy with the notion of something short of fee simple title, you know, another classification of land. And so as the matter turned around to the concept of a lesser number of fee acres rather than a greater number of subsistence acres, however described, they were very comfortable with that. And it ultimately became a matter of just deciding on how many acres there would be. So for a variety of reasons, that concept got changed.
I would also comment on that. Matter of fact, in the conference report, I wrote that section for Bill Van Ness. And there were, as Guy will recall, there was Lou Ziegler and Van Ness who were writing the conference report. And on the Senate side, Arlen Tussing and I helped Van Ness with that report. And what had happened, in effect, and I was there with Bill at the time, and if he was here, he could speak much more clearly than I. But in effect, the subsistence thing just dropped through the cracks of the very, very rushed conference committee between the House and the Senate. And in addition, that Ziegler and others in the House wanted it to drop through the cracks. But the dominant thought was on other things. And if you recall, I think it's on page 45 of the conference report, there is a expression of the Congress in congressional intent that the Secretary of Interior is directed to classify the public lands of Alaska for subsistence purposes. It's never been done. I and others have raised the question, Walt, I know, and Esther Winicky in the Federal State Land Use Planning Commission days, and I myself personally with several secretaries of the Interior, raised this question over and over again, as I did with the various heads of the Bureau of Land Management. It's still on the books as the intent of the Congress, as not in the statute per se, but certainly in the history of the Act. But it's never been done.
Just as perhaps a scrap of information to add to that, Chuck, and I've beginning to feel a little badly that I brought it up that way yesterday on the subsistence use matter, because of course it was it's merely an assertion to say that I thought that one third roughly is this way. I mean, it's just, that's an assertion. But it's a legitimate thing, certainly, to thrash out, but obviously I'd be hard put to demonstrate how it was. One would argue that a third felt that it was on the merit, and two-thirds of the argument was something else. But that aside, and trying to do a little bit more in answer to your question, a couple of facts. On old S-1830, the old Federal Field Committee proposal, as the sentence that, in the legislative write-up of it that I might recall for you, it says, no grants of subsistence use of the public lands are proposed. Reliance for protection of subsistence resources is placed in state management. Now, that was the Federal Field Committee early proposal. Now, I don't say that everything sprung from that, but I mean, that was a one base document anyway that was had it at zero, so that things, anything after that was a building on that. And in the legislative report accompanying S-1830, this one you remember about June 1970, there is a legislative write-up that says that the committee was not persuaded that even subsistence use land use arguments that were persuasive for purposes of having surface estate, that the committee felt it was not persuasive that whatever the needs were of surface estate for subsistence use required that one also own subsurface estate. So I would recall that, I think, accurately for you as some of the lines of argument if you went all the way saying not only do we need subsistence lands, but by the way, we have to own everything under it, that there was some reaction to that, is my recollection, saying, well, maybe subsistence is persuasive, but that doesn't require owning subsurface estate. That's the other addition I'd make to that.
Mr. Borbidge?
That's how it came out, too.
Comment on that, Mr. Chairman.
Oh, I'm sorry. Mr. Hope, Mr. Hope, please. Okay.
Mr. Chairman, I won't be here tomorrow, and I want to say a couple things before I leave. I'm glad for the opportunity to having been a participant. I think I conveyed the impression that I was advocating IRAs. I was just defending IRAs. I think the corporations are a very new instrument. It's likened to being thrust into major leagues without even having seen a game before, and not too many people will be off and running. It kind of reminds me, I went to radio school. That was kind of my career for a while. I was a radio announcer, and I broadcast the very first football game I ever saw. and I only have seen one since that time. I like to think I did a good job, but I know I wouldn't compete with people who were knowledgeable in that field. But I think Mr. Malott mentioned that we didn't become viable corporations until the late 70s. Probably the last 5 or 6 years, we've been in a game, and they didn't make allowances for us. I mean, in the corporate world, you're a corporate creature, and you live or die by your ability to survive. And in this day and age, in the time that we became active, we saw many a corporation take a dive, people that knew what they were doing and didn't do it right. I think CFirst, you know, millions and millions and millions of dollars, and they couldn't make it because of the times. The economy just didn't lend itself to making very many mistakes. So I think our corporations are still in that formative stage. They're still developing. But it's kind of a game that won't allow you to learn the game and still be around. So there will be some corporations that just won't survive the corporate world. If there are alternatives, I hope that they will be reviewed objectively. I think people have made up their mind on some and don't even know how they function or how they exist. And some people are suggesting that if they fail, it's the fault of the instrument, but if they succeed, it might be in spite of the instrument. I have some difficulty for that rationale. The other thing is I keep hearing from Mr. Jones that these racially defined institutions perhaps should not be there. He doesn't say that, but it's kind of the way I'm interpreting it. Then I go back to the Land Claims Act, Section 29 of the second one. This is what it says. The payments and grants authorized under this act constitute compensation for the extinguishment of claims to land and shall not be deemed to substitute for any governmental programs otherwise available to the Native people of Alaska as citizens of the United States and the state of Alaska. You know, to me, that means they address that issue and they're not going to touch it. I think the BIA and IHS are what they meant here. And further on in that same section, it says, nothing in this section shall be construed to create or terminate any trust relationship between the United States and any corporation or individual entitled to receive benefits under the Settlement Act. To me, that's very clear also. So I kind of worry if some people interpret it otherwise, that maybe the Land Claims Act meant that we'd be off and running and it'd all be equal and we don't need these, as he terms them, racially based institutions. I worry a little bit about that, and I take some comfort that the Act, I think, looked into that, and having looked into it, didn't terminate them. In fact, it did the exact opposite. I just want to express my appreciation, Mr. Chairman, because I have to get back home tomorrow. Big things are happening in our region. We're a tribe, as Mr. Borbidge has said, and a tribe is going to move into its brand new building, and I'd kind of like to be there when all of that happens. But I also didn't want to miss participation in this. I think sometimes the things that we don't think is that important and we don't attend sometimes might have an impact on you in the future. And I didn't want to miss this opportunity, and I thank you very much.
Well, I think we're all grateful that you were able to spend the week with us, Mr. Hope, and I certainly am, and I think we all appreciate the usefulness of every intervention you've made. And I wondered if, since you seem to be directing much of what you said at Mr. Jones, whether he wanted to reply at all.
No, Mr. Chairman, I believe you. I have no chance to reply to him.
No. There was one, just one other thing that had come up that I just wanted any comments on. Walter Parker, in his paper, in his summation, said, operating under state sovereignty probably offers a greater range of political and economic options for the future of Alaskan Natives than does a return to federal sovereignty. The political perils are obvious by the present composition of the Alaska legislature and its increasing urbanization, and Mr. Parker mentioned that yesterday. However, the urban areas have elected many who worked hard for programs and laws benefiting Alaska Natives in the past, and there is no reason why that should not occur in the future. Insofar as the possibility is of creating a special form of sovereignty, either federal or state, we must bear in mind that the ultimate sovereignty was originally vested in the states, except where the Constitution or the Congress preempted that sovereignty. Well, we can leave that argument for the moment. He says the Civil War pretty well nailed down the bounds of separatism in the American Union, and I guess that's something nobody can argue with. and unless some forms of Commonwealth approach were taken, there would not seem to be many options. And then he says, and I wonder, Mr. Paul, if you have any views on this, the way in which the parcels of native lands have been interspersed with state and federal lands over most regions of the state would make it difficult to give such sovereignty any cohesive geographical expression. I think that speaks for itself, and I'm just curious whether you would like to comment, and then I'll ask Mr. Borbridge for his views.
That word sovereignty, I guess, has 100 different meanings.
What he's saying is if you wanted to have IRAs governing tribal lands, how can you do it with the land scattered all over the place?
That, again, requires a definition of sovereignty. You say, when I say you, rhetorical you, do you mean the management of fish and game? Do you mean management of zoning? Do you mean ownership in fee simple, except for the trust quality of IRAs? I'm going to say that there is a movement within the government of Alaska that they're not going to stand for any sovereignty over fish and game. There may be some yielding on subsistence, but so far as sovereignty is concerned, it's going to be a tough battle. But whether the state government's for, again, sovereignty, the state government has exhibited an indifference to rural Alaska. Now, there have been huge inroads in rural Alaska for the benefit of the Alaska Natives. I do not expect the state legislature to enhance sovereignty at all. I think the gains in education in particular have been, in a sense, stuffed down the legislature's throat. It had to be the Molly Hooch case where the Alaska Supreme Court said bring high schools to the bush. The North Slope Borough is a great experience in assisting in education. Marvelous, you know, just beautiful, but not a product of the state legislature. The neglect of the unorganized borough. The unorganized borough has an assembly. It's never met. It happens to be the state legislature, and the governor is supposed to be mayor of the unorganized borough, so to speak. So I can see problems in the management of fish and game by IRAs where you have checkerboard ownership. I find it very difficult to believe that the state legislature is going to yield any sovereignty in that regard.
I see.
Those are my remarks.
Mr. Borbridge, you wanted to add something.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. I almost sense that, as Mr. Paul indicated, we're victims of a term that's not quite defined, and so we're able to perhaps give it various meanings. I tied in with Mr. Hickok's earlier mention that the United States is the sovereign, which in that case is a reference to where is the supreme power. However, within the relationship that the American Indians and Alaska Natives have had with the United States, we have the exercise of sovereignty by the tribes. Sovereignty is an attribute of their tribal existence by which they are able to make certain determinations, such as those that are made by various levels of government to whom certain powers are delegated. But in this instance, the powers of sovereignty delegated by tribes are not those that are delegated to them, but rather are those that are an outgrowth of their existence as tribes. During their existence as tribes, true, in recognition now of this other sense of sovereignty, the sovereign power acting through the Congress has in fact been able to, has the power and has used the power to restrict the exercise of some of the powers of tribes. But again, it's important to appreciate that the origin of these powers are as old as the tribes themselves and precede the formation of our nation. I think we are beginning to use almost interchangeably this sense of sovereignty as it refers to a supreme governing power, the federal government, and sovereignty as an exercise of an attribute that a tribe possesses. I think we're all pretty much aware that through the Non-Intercourse Acts, the federal government made quite clear that certain relationships with the Indian tribes were reserved to and were the exclusive domain of the federal government. Having given that background, I then consider that what Mr. Parker may be referring to is that it's possible that the Indian and Native tribes in Alaska might conceivably, in the exercise of powers of sovereignty, and one example, clear example of a power of sovereignty is the right to determine one's membership in the tribe. That is something that the tribe determines. Another, if they have the land base, is the power of taxation or regulation over the ownership of certain things such as land and other tribal property. These are exercises of sovereignty. And I think the suggestion made that the shift in sovereignty from state to federal is perhaps not so much a change in the sovereignty, the power exercised by the tribe, because that in fact may not be assumed by the state government. It simply doesn't have that power. That is the province of the federal government. But the tribe exercising sovereignty as a tribe, subject to state laws and regulations, conceivably within that framework, could decide that it will want to function within it, or law may determine it, and the tribe will be subject, as it is now, to certain state regulations that pertain to all citizens and by force of the law to the tribe itself. So I do caution us, all of us, against the notion that the sovereignty is readily transferable. It is not, or that it can be diminished by a non-federal entity. It may not be, nor do we as members of our tribe challenge the notion that the federal government is the supreme power. It is, but we have existed as tribes, as has been defined before, as domestic dependent nations, and there has been a gradual change in the terminology, but it follows pretty much the development of the law since that time. So this is no specific answer, but I think it does say certain things that have been said are not correct as far as their jurisdiction and their pertinency to tribal sovereignty, Mr. Chairman.
Did you want to add something, Mr. Hickman?
Remind John about something. At the time of the dialogue in the Congress, there was testimony after testimony after testimony from Native Alaskans themselves that outside of the Tlingit Haida, there were linguistic groupings and there were ethnological groupings, but that, and this is in the words of many, many Alaska Natives, that we did not have tribes. And that, I would refer you to the written testimony.
Pleased to speak to that, Mr. Chairman. Likewise, we refer again to the past. This is the Native way. That way we don't keep repeating the same mistakes. And One is that historically, the Alaska Natives, like the Native American nation of which they are a part and were clearly a part then, therefore, have also been caught in the flow of history. Let me give you an example. I agree with Mr. Havelock's comment, and others have commented, that had there been a settlement a year later, and I think it was even suggested months later, there may have been, there would have been less land, less money, and a few other changes that we wouldn't have been happy with. I suggest that if there had been a change, a settlement prior to 1871, remember that would have been a settlement in which not only the native tribes or groups up here would have received lands, but there would have been, consistent with national policy, a need to settle with tribes as such. And so the United States, as was the policy at the time, would not only have settled the question of land and the ownership to land, but would likewise have dealt, as it had been dealing, with Indian tribes. It would have had to define more about the tribal government, because up to 1871, tribes had been, as a matter of fact, dealt with by virtue of treaties. And once the practice was changed and there was a move backwards by the federal government from dealing through treaties and therefore recognizing tribes as sovereign independent nations, there was a lessening of a need by the federal government to do anything about recognizing tribes as they negotiated out settlements. Here in Alaska, we were subject to the same flow of history, but just as I'd indicated previously, we benefited because the land claims was not dealt with, although promised in 84, and therefore we benefited from a number of things by 1971. Also during that same time, Interior did not, in fact, ever complete its obligation to address the status of the Alaska Natives. The fact that they were not, however, called tribes, denoted as tribe, did not indicate that they did not regard themselves as such. It is merely not spelled out in the legislation. Whether we call tribalism or tribes a manifestation of Alaska nativeness, which fits within the total flow of history from Native Americans, I just don't find any inconsistency. The fact that what Mr. Hickok in large part said was true does not mean that they did not so regard themselves as a part of Native Americans. They were, they are, they were then.
That's fine. The problem comes down to a very, I don't argue that. The problem comes down to the way the Congress received the testimony and, in turn, provided the compensation. The package of compensation only involved proprietary jurisdiction, not legislative jurisdiction or judicial jurisdiction, in the bundle of aspects that make up whatever definition of sovereignty you want. So it becomes moot, in my opinion, because the message came to the Congress, and the Congress in turn gave back the jurisdiction only in the proprietary sense.
Mr. Havelock?
Somebody else over there want to talk?
Mr. Parker? Oh, sorry.
I just wanted to briefly describe what I meant by sovereignty in this case, and I was using it by then in its narrowest legal sense of the powers that exist between the federal and the state government and the division of them. I think it's confused in the United States sometime when Congress ran off with all the boodle in 1913 with the federal income tax. Why, of course, they acquired power over the states that simply by cracking the fiscal whip, and that confuses the situation as to how much actual federal power exists in key areas that are closest to home of any individual, and police, education, health, and so forth. And it was in that context, which I addressed earlier in the paper, that I was saying it would be difficult under the present land distribution to give geographical expression to any form of new sovereignty. And I think it is difficult to define, and using the term sovereignty, which is in essence a legal term of the Western institutions, to describe inherent tribal rights may confuse the issue, and we probably should not use the sovereignty in that sense.
Mr. Havelock?
At the risk of the rest of the lawyers here jumping on me, I might wade into that a little bit. The sovereignty isn't really, in the context we're talking about it, a legal term so much as it a term from political science and international law. As John Borbidge mentioned, the form in which Indian law was treated changed with, I guess, 1871, when the United States said it wasn't going to work via treaties anymore. From my perspective as a lawyer, from that time on, when anybody here is talking about contemporary tribal sovereignty, what they're talking about is jurisdiction. And when addressing, and that jurisdiction is whatever the Congress of the United States defines as being that jurisdiction. Now, there's not, the exception I would take, or it's not so much an exception as a broadening of what Mr. Parker was saying, is that is I think he neglects to look at the various bases for jurisdiction beyond territoriality. You also have jurisdiction over the subject matter and jurisdiction over the person, for example. And the jurisdiction of tribal entities with respect to its potential scope goes as far as federal power goes. And if you look, and that would be gauged, it would seem to me, in part by the scope that has been given to the rest of the Indian Clause, which is the Interstate Commerce Clause, which allows for an enormous potential breadth of federal jurisdiction, so that if the Congress was so disposed, they could write an act creating federal Indian corporations that had enormous jurisdictional power over persons, subject matter, and for that matter, places. It seems to me the only ultimate, that is, once under the Supremacy Clause, once you decide that the Congress has the power to do something, it is simply if they can adopt any reasonable means to bring that about. And if the under the Commerce Clause, the as it has been interpreted, the United States has the authority to deal with the welfare of Indian people on a broad scale, then there is very little limitation to what they could do with, by respect of granting jurisdiction to political subunits, to such as Indian tribes, on a wide variety of things. The only ultimate limitation seems to me you'd run into is when you start hitting other provisions of the Bill of Rights, notably the Due Process Clause. In some senses, the Indian Clause already has a little bit of an exception carved in it to, with respect to equal protection. But due process might pose a limitation in that part of it involving the taking of property, that is, or the deprivation of liberty without due process of law. And when you look at the body of law on that topic generally, the government of the United States can regulate all over the place without depriving people of property, as for example, as coming very close by regulation to expropriating the ordinary uses of property, for example, is considered regulation, even though it may deprive people of the ordinary and usual use of that property, So long as I understand the law on this, maybe David Case or some more expert could go on it, but so long as it doesn't involve sort of the transfer of a property interest from one group to another, that is, if it is carrying out a basically regulatory function, then the Congress is without limitation. So the requirement of a cohesive geographical expression, it does not seem to me to be a significant limitation on federal power. If the government of the United States decided that, for example, that in the interest of protecting fish, game, water, you name it, on with respect to the use of Indians, that they could pass those regulations and not worry a whole lot about where these little scribble lines are on maps that separate out the jurisdictions.
Well, Mr. Gentlemen and ladies, my sense of things is, especially in view of the fact that we have to leave at 4 p.m., that we have had a good 5 days, and certainly I want to thank Mr. Borbridge and Mr. Hope and Mr. Starr and Mr. Paul who've been with us for those 5 days. We ended up this afternoon on the subject that we're going to explore next week, starting on Tuesday with Native leaders and scholars from the lower 48. And it occurs to me that this may be an appropriate point at which to terminate our discussion. Mr. Case and Rosita Worrell and I thought that it might be an imposition to ask you to come back tomorrow in view of the fact that some of you are leaving and in view of the fact that it's a Saturday and we've had an excellent discussion. David suggested we have what he calls a reality check. I'm not quite sure what that is, but we just have a few minutes this afternoon, and I think that we've had an excellent discussion, and unless any of you feel that we've left any avenues unexplored that should be explored tomorrow, I'm inclined as chairman say that it's a good idea to conclude a session like this when everyone still feels that they have that it has been an advantage to be here. Let's put it that way. I think that you know that the first 3 days this week we discussed what Native people wanted to achieve under ANCSA. We've had some time to talk about what the legislators in Congress thought they were trying to achieve, and we're grateful to our visitors from the lower 48, Mr. Martin and Mr. Van Ness and Professor Jones, and of course to Mr. Havelock, who was then in Juneau, for informing us on that subject. We've had a we've discussed some ideas for the future, and I hope that next week, because you've raised IRAs, reservations, sovereignty, I hope next week we can take a good look at these things from the point of view of lower 48 people who've had to live with those institutions. And I should add that in addition to our panel for next week convening here Tuesday, and they are people from the lower 48, I've invited the AFN and the UTA, the Alaska Federation of Natives and the United Tribes of Alaska, each to participate by having somebody at the table to ask questions, and I hope we can arrange that. We've talked about it, and I hope it can be worked out. And I think that would add very much to those discussions to make sure that all points of view are canvassed. The week after that, that is, a week from Tuesday, we will have representatives from Canada, Greenland, Australia, Norway, and perhaps other countries to talk about the mechanisms, the instruments that they've used to manage their land and govern their affairs. And it may be we'll get some new ideas out of all this. In addition, of course, the purpose of the commission is as well to enable people in those other countries to learn from the Alaskan experience. That's why there's a transcript. I hope that the report that comes out of this next year will be of use not only to Alaskans but to people in other countries. May I repeat something that, reiterate something that was said earlier, I've forgotten by whom, but that is, it seems to me that it is wise in such a discussion as this. It has been diffuse at some times, perhaps overly general at times, but you have to start somewhere. You have to nail the first board to something. And I think that if we have discussions next week and the week after that are equally useful, then the visits to the villages and the meetings there will will enable us to know what people really want to do. Where do people, how do people feel about all this? What do they really want to do? Then we can call in some of the legal and constitutional experts and say, well, this appears to be what people have in mind. These are the directions they want to go in. How can we achieve this? And I want to remind those who have attended the meetings as members of the public, we've tried to accommodate as many of you as we could. Some of you have spoken once, some twice. One of you I know wanted to give a 45-minute talk, and I said no because I felt that would be asking too much time, given the fact that none of the panel have given a talk of that length, at least not that I can remember. We will be holding a village meeting in Anchorage. It may take a night or two nights or three nights, however long it is required, and we will be in other villages and communities throughout Alaska through the remainder of the year. I've had 5 days of village meetings last week and 5 days of these meetings this week, and I wouldn't mind having a couple of days for reflection. There's been an awful lot of interesting and worthwhile things said, and I hope all of you have found it useful, a useful exchange of views, and in my view, a good beginning. So if you don't all hate me one way or another for suggesting that we wrap it up now, that's what I intend to do. And we'll reconvene again on Tuesday morning at 9 a.m. when the people from the lower 48 will be here. And I just want to thank you all again most sincerely for your participation. My pleasure.
Right. Yeah. Calendar week.